The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Hello listeners, it's Yasmin here and great to have your company. So today I'm interviewing somebody called Rena Palmer. Now Rena, if you've not come across her before, she's a counsel at Freshfield Solicitors. She's got a very impressive CV. She's Champion of the Year 2023, Inspirational Woman in Law Awards, Enable Role Model 2023, and she's currently the chair of the Disabled Solicitors Network at the Law Society of England and Wales. I know Rena because I was formerly the vice chair of the Disabled Solicitors Network, and Rena was a committee member at the time, and then shortly afterwards became chair of the DSN. I met her for a drink at Christmas. We began talking about disability inclusion in the legal profession, the fact that Rena has a disability herself and is also a carer. And we spoke about some of the ways that the legal profession could be more inclusive for people with a disability, or perhaps they're a carer as well. And I thought she'd be a great person to have on the podcast. I've got two kind of standout moments when Rena was talking to me. One, how practical she is in terms of what you can do if you identify as a disabled person and you're in the legal profession or you want to get into the legal profession. What is it you can actively do to help your chances of succeeding and getting into the profession? I thought that was incredibly useful for people. The second part was, I guess, when Rena shared her own vulnerability. She shared the fact that she's had depression, and that was really helpful in terms of really bringing these issues to life, making it real for people, and being able to have that vulnerability to enable us to have this conversation and to open up this conversation to other people.
The Hearing.
Hello, Rena Palmer. Welcome to The Hearing podcast. It's great to see you.
Thank you for having me, Yasmin. I'm really excited for our conversation today.
Me too. Thank you for agreeing to do this interview with me. So Rena, I think you're quite prolific on LinkedIn and some people may know you anyway, but I'd love for you to share your journey in the legal profession. And second part of that question is, what motivated you to become an advocate for disabled solicitors? And you can tell us a little bit about your work in that area as well.
Sure. Well, I'm a solicitor, currently counsel in the global transactions practice of a large international law firm that's headquartered in London. Going back to my early days, I was state school educated, the first in my family to graduate from university, the first to work in professional services. So I didn't really know what I was getting into in the early days, but I took a traditional route into law in that I studied a law degree at King's College London, and then I did the legal practice course. And then once I completed my studies, I did a two-year training contract at another international law firm before I qualified. I went on to work as a client-facing transactional lawyer for 10 years before switching roles to become a knowledge lawyer, and I was promoted to counsel in 2023. My interest in disability stems both from my own experience and supporting my family. So I have my own less visible disabilities, which developed during my working career around 8 years ago. Those are fluctuating and dynamic conditions that impact my working life in various ways day to day. In particular, I experience chronic pain and fatigue, and sometimes I need to use a mobility aid. But I'm also a carer. I'm parent to two neurodivergent teenagers and a carer for a parent with disabilities. In fact, I was a young carer, as I've been caring for my mother since I was 9 years old. So in terms of what motivated me to become an advocate for disabled solicitors, there were three defining moments for me. The first was the onset of my disability 9 years ago, when my world changed overnight. Whilst I was learning to live with my diagnoses and trying to figure out how to manage work alongside health, I felt quite alone because so few people spoke openly about health or disability within the profession at that time. And I also couldn't see any disabled senior role models that I identified with in the workplace. And so that made me doubt my prospects for career progression. The pandemic was another defining moment for me, as it gave me the impetus to reflect on what I could do to create a more inclusive culture within the profession, rather than focusing on what I couldn't do as a result of the barriers that I faced because of my disability. And that change in mindset was transformative for me. I chose to use my skills to become a disability advocate within my law firm and then broadly in the legal profession to create a sense of community for those that identify as disabled or neurodivergent, to help engage allies on my journey and to drive inclusion and change for those that follow in my footsteps. And the third defining moment was when my children were diagnosed as neurodivergent. They have faced so many barriers and challenges in their childhood, navigating a world that hasn't been designed with their needs in mind. And they really inspire me to do what I do, which is to keep pushing the boundaries on disability and neuroinclusion in the hope that the working world will one day be more welcoming and inclusive for neurodivergent children like them. So that personal journey with disability led me to co-founding and co-chairing a disability network at my law firm, which I did for 2.5 years before going on to be appointed as chair of the Law Society of England and Wales Disabled Solicitors Network, which is a network that promotes equal opportunities for disabled people working within the legal profession.
Great. Thank you, Rena. And that's how we met, really, isn't it? That our time overlapped there at the Disabled Solicitors Network, where I was vice chair. And then I've since left that and you've taken over as chair. How long have you been chair? Remind me.
I have been chair for 1.5 years now. It's gone by
wow.
Very fast.
It goes very quickly, yeah. And so not every... a couple of things come out for me when you were speaking, Rena. Not everyone identifies with the label of disabled. So what does that actually mean? Who could join the Disabled Solicitors Network?
Well, actually, the Disabled Solicitors Network is open to anyone that wants to join. You don't have to identify as disabled or neurodivergent. We welcome allies and anyone that's interested in driving inclusion in the space. You also don't need to be a solicitor to join the network. We have students, we have academics, we have legal services professionals all on our network committee and more broadly within the network. So we very much encourage anyone that's interested in this area to join our network, and they can do that by signing up on the Law Society website via the My TLS section.
Great, thank you, that's helpful. So as chair of the Disabled Solicitors Network, what are your primary goals and initiatives for the upcoming year?
Well, we have lots lined up. In May, a team led by my vice chair, Demi Rickson, plans to publish some guidance on factors to consider when beginning an organisational digital accessibility journey. As we've noted, that digital accessibility is a significant issue that needs to be addressed within the profession. And then on 18th of June, the DSN will be participating in the London Legal Walk, raising funds to help the London Legal Support Trust continue their much needed work, which includes supporting disabled people and their carers with access to justice. We're really looking forward to that, as it's a great opportunity for us to meet network members and supporters, as well as other legal diversity and inclusion networks. And it's also important to us to have a presence in a place where people may not expect to see disabled people, as that's one way in which we can help to raise awareness and dispel some of the myths and assumptions around disability. We're also seeking to grow the number of organisations that have signed up to Project Rise. Project Rise is a Disabled Solicitors Network and Law Society, as well as a cross-law firm in-house legal team initiative to introduce flexible training that was spearheaded by Lizzie Hardy from the DSN committee with the support of Chris Seal from the Law Society. And that project is around flexible training is not exclusively designed to benefit disabled trainees. We think there are many people from diverse backgrounds who would benefit from having the option of completing their training in a flexible way, including those with caring responsibilities. And we already have 5 law firms that are part of that program, and a big in-house legal department is soon going to be joining as part of the next cohort. We're really passionate about Project Rise, as we believe that flexibility and agility around training contracts could help open up the profession to a more diverse pool of talent. And then towards the end of the year, mid-November to mid-December each year, is Disability History Month. We will be marking this as a network, as we do every year, and we will be building on our success in 2023, where we saw a massive increase in engagement and really encouraging signs of organisations wanting to host disability-related events. Importantly, this year's Disability History Month, so 2024 Disability History Month, marks the fifth anniversary of the publication of the Legally Disabled Research and Report, which was co-produced between Cardiff University Business School and a number of organisations, including the Disabled Solicitors Network and the Law Society. And I want to spend a minute on that, because that research was groundbreaking. For the first time, leaders in law had an evidence-based report that highlighted the inequalities faced by disabled lawyers in the profession, as well as a list of recommendations for areas of improvement. And that research and the related report have been instrumental in terms of the increased focus on disability inclusion within the legal profession. And it's guided the work of the DSN ever since. And so we're really keen to kind of promote that research 5 years on in Disability History Month this year. And then we'll have continuing engagement with the Solicitors Regulation Authority on the Solicitors Qualification Exam, or SQE, and also with the Legal Services Board to ensure that disabled people's experiences are reflected in the research and in what they are trying to do to make the profession more inclusive. We'll also have ongoing engagement and awareness raising amongst our network members and beyond through attending events and panel discussions, publishing articles, guidance and other resources. So we've got lots and lots going on, and I would urge people to join the network, because they'll be there at the centre of what we're doing.
Yeah, full agenda, certainly. Lots for you to all do. Yes, the Legal Walk is a great event. I did that last year, and I think last year was the first year, if I remember correctly, that it was fully accessible for people with a disability. So there's shorter routes for people who may have challenges completing the full route. And as a wheelchair user, I remember the original route wasn't accessible for me at all. So they've really thought about how do we ensure that everybody can take part, whether you do a shorter distance or an accessible route. So it's a win-win, really, in terms of raising those vital funds for people. So, yeah, really encourage people to check that out and take part. And the Legally Disabled research, I agree, is a great piece of research. I think the research actually said, didn't it, that pre-pandemic, the most requested and refused reasonable adjustment was home working and flexible working. Now, lo and behold, we have a pandemic. That's become a mainstream concern and a priority for many, many businesses. And even now the model has been, you know, questioned. Should everybody go into the office 9 to 5 every single day? And the resounding answer was no, that doesn't work for everybody. And I think over 70% of the respondents, all with a disability, said working from home or working flexibly has been truly life changing, not having to navigate those barriers. So, great piece of research. I'm sure you'll do lots of have lots of opportunities to promote that throughout the year. Rena, what have been some of the most significant challenges that disabled solicitors face in the legal profession today? I think the Legally Disabled research highlighted what are those barriers, what are the challenges that we face.
It really did. It articulated the barriers and challenges very well, and I really would urge listeners to take a look at that. Or the executive summary. But in essence, the challenges are wide-reaching. I couldn't possibly do it all justice in the time we have, so I'm just going to cherry-pick a few from the research. Securing reasonable adjustments was a prominent theme highlighted by the research across the life cycle of the employment cycle, from application stage, when candidates are fearful around the disadvantage that they might face if they share their disability and ask for adjustments at interview, through to retention and progression. The report recommended that employers and their representatives improve their understanding of the variety of reasonable adjustments available. And that led the Legally Disabled research team, including Debbie Foster and Natasha Hurst, as well as a DSN committee led by Jane Burton, the then chair, and you, Yasmin, as vice chair at the time, to produce guidance to help organisations understand what they're legally obliged to do in terms of reasonable adjustments, and also some guidance on how to implement them. So our reasonable adjustments guidance that's available on the Law Society website includes real examples from many firms and organisations that have been collated to share best practice of what's being done. We've also held regional roundtables to promote that guidance and share that best practice. In addition, in the past, firms and organisations, I think, have kind of sidelined or ignored disability in their diversity inclusion agenda on the basis that it was just too hard to tackle. And we wanted to break down that perception and show that there are some easy wins. So we published an Easy Wins and Action Points document that has differentiated versions for smaller and larger organisations. And those highlight the easy wins, questions to get discussions going, or starting points for further work. The aim is to support organisations to start or improve the process of understanding the barriers faced by disabled people, and to then take steps to embed disability, equality and equity into their policies, procedures and organisational culture. The research also articulated the current uneven playing field that disadvantages disabled job applicants, and the DSN Network Committee recognises that this disadvantage is particularly acute for disabled students and aspiring solicitors that are on the cusp of starting their legal career as they transition from higher education into the workplace, and that may deter some students from pursuing a career in law. So we've published Disabled Students Guidance, which explains the support available for disabled students that are thinking of becoming solicitors. And that covers reasonable adjustments in higher education and beyond into the workplace, as well as funding opportunities and tips in relation to sharing information about disability with employers. The research also found that the profession was wedded to traditional ways of working, with widespread practice of trying to fit a disabled person into a standard job role rather than redesigning job roles to accommodate the disabled person. And, you know, as you mentioned, with regard to kind of hybrid and working from home, the pandemic introduced different models of working, including hybrid and flexible working. And that was really positive in terms of the retention of diverse talent within the profession. But we're already starting to see some signs of rollback of remote and hybrid working practices. And I think we need to carefully guard against the return to pre-COVID working practices, which excluded disabled people. And then the Project Rise initiative for flexible training contracts, which I mentioned earlier, is an example of a DSN initiative to try and break down some of the traditional attitudes and working practices for trainees that have acted as barriers to inclusion, by demonstrating that flexible training can work at a conceptual as well as a practical level, and that that can result in opening the profession up to a more diverse pool of candidates who may previously have self-selected themselves out of working in the profession based on perception of historic rigid working practices. The research also recommends an assessment throughout the profession on how technology can facilitate more accessible working practices, but also on how technology might inhibit accessibility. And I mentioned earlier that later this year, we hope to publish some guidance on factors to consider when beginning an organisational digital accessibility. And that will be the first in a series of guidance notes covering various aspects of technology and accessibility. There were many, many other recommendations of the Legally Disabled research. And as a committee, we do look back to that research when we're deciding on our goals and objectives for each year. So, for example, we recognise that there is still work to be done in recruitment, as the research highlights that disabled people are often being filtered out of the recruitment process by external recruitment agencies, and also that further work is needed on the impact of the use of artificial intelligence in recruitment of disabled people. So lots more for us to do and to work on.
Yeah, yeah. And I know the research said, because you mentioned it, that disabled people were often the forgotten group when you think about other strands of diversity and inclusion. I think what's going on, I'd love to hear your thoughts, but it might be that I hear organisations saying, well, we don't have any disabled people, because they have a very narrow definition of what a disabled person is supposed to look like. You know, it's not just sticks and wheelchairs. So there's a misunderstanding what a disability actually is. And I do think there's still a prejudice, a bias, that people have a lower expectation a soft bigotry of low expectation when it comes to disabled people. And assumptions are made, aren't they? Massive assumptions about somebody's capability. This is a very competitive field, the legal profession. And some people may have the attitude, well, if you can't cut it, then you shouldn't be able to enter the profession. So it's probably a good time to sort of bust a few myths and ask you this question, which is kind of connected to my comment. In your opinion, Rena, how does increasing diversity, particularly with respect to disability, enrich the legal profession for those who need to understand the business case, certainly the moral case, but the business case for including disabled people in this profession?
Good question. Well, we know that diversity and inclusion overall is something to be embraced, because as a knowledge-based profession that's centred around technical expertise and thought leadership, diversity leads to innovation, creative problem solving, reduced risk, better decision making and governance. It also brings our profession closer to and more representative of the communities that we serve. But honing in on disability, from a disability perspective, when you consider that around 25% of the UK population is disabled, of that, around 80% have non-visible disabilities. And then from a neurodivergence perspective, between 50 to 20% of the UK population identify as neurodivergent. And then one in five adults in the UK are providing unpaid care for their loved ones. Well, those statistics should hopefully make it clear that disability, neurodivergence and caring responsibilities are not minority issues. So why would you exclude such a significant part of the population from your workforce, from your equality, diversity and inclusion initiatives, or from your potential sources of revenue from clients? And so disability inclusion is a strategic business imperative. It can lead to greater productivity, revenue, income, profit, but it's also the right thing to do morally and ethically. And by leaning into the challenge and focusing on this critical area, law firms and organisations can play an essential role in changing some of the negative narrative around disability. You mentioned some of that earlier. And that in turn can help to normalise disability and challenge broader stereotypes and misconceptions around disability that exist within society. So, for example, greater disability inclusion in the profession can help challenge the perception that disabled people are objects of charity or pity, that they are deficient somehow or don't have what it takes to succeed, or that disabled people are less efficient or productive than others. We have some wonderful examples of disabled role models that are thriving in their professional careers and helping to break down some of those negative stereotypes. And a commitment to disability inclusion also reinforces the overall workplace culture of inclusion, which can only be a good thing, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah, very full answer there. And disability doesn't mean inability.
Exactly.
I think a lot of people think it means you're unable. I mean, I, from my experience, I don't know what you think, Rena, but the disabled people that I certainly encounter are really good problem solvers, because we have to be, because the world's not, on the whole, built for us. So we've got to find about ways about how to do something a different way, find shortcuts that can lead to a lot of creativity and innovation and resilience. So it's tapping into those skills and insights and different perspectives that perhaps disabled lawyers have as well, their unique perspective.
The hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day, in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
to the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.
You touched on aspiring solicitors as well, who are disabled. They may feel quite daunted because I still think there are a lack of disabled role models in the legal profession. I mean, you're speaking about it. I know you're a role model. I'm seeing a change, but I still think we've got a long way to go in terms of people who are open, openly talking about their own disability and the barriers they've had to navigate to get to the top of their profession. What advice would you give to young aspiring solicitors, or even may not be young, that's an assumption on my part, maybe people who have been out of the profession, want to get back in, who may have a disability? What would you say to them, Rena?
So my baseline message is we want you. We want disabled and neurodivergent aspiring solicitors to enter the profession and to bring with them their wealth of talents and strengths and diversity of thought. But I know it can be a daunting prospect as the competition is intense and you're competing against candidates that have not experienced the same barriers and challenges that you may have faced or are facing. And there continues to be the historic perception that the legal profession is not inclusive of those that are disabled or that are neurodivergent because of outmoded practices and hierarchical structures. You know, while that might have been the case in the past, I'm pleased to say it is slowly changing. I've observed a gradual shift in the profession since 2020, with firms openly acknowledging that disability inclusion is just as important as other strands of diversity in terms of equity, diversity, inclusion strategies, and with more and more role models in the profession speaking up openly about their journey with disability and neurodivergence. But in the many conversations that I've had with aspiring solicitors since becoming chair of the DSN, time and time again, I'm seeing aspiring solicitors self-select themselves out in certain ways. So, for example, by deciding that larger law firms or international law firms won't want them and therefore there's no point in applying to them. And in that way, limiting the pool that they are applying to based on the perception that they themselves are not good enough or that they will not fit in to that, that organization's culture and environment. So for any disabled aspiring solicitors out there that are listening, I have some tips. First, there are disabled role models out there that are progressing and thriving in their careers. Have faith that if they did it, that you can do it too. We've got some great examples of disabled role models on the DSN committee. You can find details of them on the Law Society's website for the Disabled Solicitors Network. But there are partners, there are associates, there are solicitors in private practice. So they are out there if you look for them. I'd also recommend joining networks such as the Disabled Solicitors Network or the Legal Neurodiversity Network, which is an up-and-coming network that is having just incredible impact in the neurodiversity space. We have a number of student members in the DSN, and I think it's a great way for aspiring solicitors to develop their own network of contacts and join a supportive community. I said it before and I'll say it again, you don't need to be a solicitor to join the DSN, so please do join. I'd also recommend checking out the Disabled Students Guidance, which I mentioned earlier. That's available on the Law Society's website and should help to address some of the common queries and concerns that disabled aspiring solicitors have. I would also recommend applying for the Law Society's Diversity Access Scheme, because successful candidates get access to work experience, funding for exams, as well as mentoring. And in previous years, quite a large proportion of successful candidates have identified as disabled. And so there is great representation in the cohorts coming through from the Diversity Access Scheme. Also seek mentoring, either through a formal scheme or through informal means. I don't think it's ever too soon for mentoring. And I really, really wish that I had explored mentoring when I was at a more junior stage in my career. I'd also say ask for adjustments if you need them during the application process and an interview, because that's the best way to set yourself up for success. And if a firm is not willing to accommodate them, then that kind of, I think, is a red flag right there. And work experience is often an area that disabled aspiring solicitors struggle with. But and I've spoken about this a few times to various people recently. I would urge disabled aspiring solicitors to bear in mind that work experience is more than just vacation schemes. You can gain experience through virtual internships, which often don't require formal applications, through observing court proceedings, through paralegaling at high street practices, and through volunteering at free law clinics. The key is to show the skills that you've developed through your experiences and then to articulate those on your CV and at interview. And finally, I would say don't be disheartened by rejection. I know it's hard, but keep trying and have confidence in the value that you will bring as an individual, not just through your technical knowledge, but also through your life experiences and skills.
Some great advice. I wish you were my mentor when I was a solicitor, a practicing one, should I say. I acquired my injury, you know, once I'd qualified. So it's really interesting and insightful to hear, you know, what are those barriers? Because I didn't experience them because I was a non-disabled person at that point. So obviously it's harder to get into the profession when you are presented with those barriers as well. So Rina, you mentioned in your introduction about your background, there were some other barriers apart from having a disability in terms of, you know, people have multiple identities. I am mixed race, I have a disability, I'm a woman. That may present challenges getting into a profession that is largely not necessarily for you, designed for you. So my question to you is, how does the network collaborate with other diversity and inclusion groups within the legal profession?
We're really proud of the fact that we regularly engage with other organisations, as we recognise that broader systemic change requires collaboration. So, for example, we've actively supported the Legal Neurodiversity Network, or LNN. I mentioned that earlier. LNN is an example of change being driven by grassroots initiatives, which has had fantastic engagement and positive outcomes. That network has grown significantly in such a short period of time, and they're having demonstrable impact. So I'm really proud to support the important work they do in this space. We speak to LNN regularly and are, you know, kind of really aligned with what they're trying to achieve, because that aligns with what we're trying to achieve in the DSM. We also regularly meet with LawCare, recognising that mental health and disability are interconnected. And so we meet to share information and explore opportunities to collaborate with LawCare. I recently recorded a podcast for the My Legal Mind podcast series by LawCare. We also touch base regularly with representatives of the General Council for Diversity and Inclusion Disability Workstream, in order to spot synergies and opportunities to collaborate with them. We think that's a really important relationship because it's driven by in-house general counsel who are really keen to ensure that the firms and organisations that they work with, you know, are factoring in disability inclusion into their diversity and inclusion initiatives. We're also connected with organisations and groups such as the Society of Visually Impaired Lawyers, or SOVIL, City Disabilities, and Aspiring Solicitors. And we're mindful around intersectionality. You know, I have several intersecting identities as well, being a disabled cis woman of South Asian heritage from a humble background. So I'm very mindful of that. And we do some cross-sectional work with other law society diversity inclusion networks, such as the Women Solicitors Network. And through those collaborations, I think we can amplify our message that disability and neuroinclusion deserve and demand greater focus and attention, and that they're an essential part of the equity, diversity, inclusion conversation in the legal profession. We can also dispel some of the common myths and misconceptions around disability and neurodivergence by collectively generating open dialogue, providing a platform for storytelling, and spotlighting role models that are helping to drive change.
Great, thank you, Rina. And you mentioned LawCare, and I'm seeing lots of articles and you know, very sad stories about lawyers really having challenges with mental health issues. LawCare is a great organisation. Could you tell us a little bit about, do you know enough about LawCare? People can get in touch with them, can't they, if they're experiencing a challenge?
Yeah, it's open to anyone in the legal profession that that is kind of struggling with their mental health. And they provide a really essential source of support because they understand the pressures that we face in the legal profession. It's led by Elizabeth Rimmer, who's just a complete powerhouse and someone that I really kind of look up to. And I'll be honest, I've suffered mental health challenges myself. You know, certainly when navigating the early years of my disability, it was a real struggle and I went through a period of depression. And more recently, you know, I felt quite overwhelmed by things going on in the world outside, as well as the pressures and challenges that I face as a carer. And what LawCare can do is they can either signpost you to helpful resources, or if you need funding, they, you know, provide you meet their criteria, you can get access to counselling through them. And I know that they've had tremendous impact with people in the profession. So I really would urge anyone that's struggling with their mental health to think about looking up LawCare and engaging with them.
Yeah, I would echo that as well. You mentioned you are a carer for your family members. What would you say is an inclusive working practice for carers? What is your experience of that, Rina?
I think carers are often forgotten in the diversity and inclusion conversation, to be completely honest. And I think organisations need to acknowledge that carers and their workforce need support too. Those who care for loved ones that are disabled or have a long-term health condition or are neurodivergent play such an important role in society. This is often an unpaid role. And while it can be immensely rewarding and fulfilling, it can also take a real mental and physical toll on the carer. Speaking from experience, it can be exhausting to juggle caring responsibilities with work responsibilities. I'm so fortunate to work in a team that flexes to support me as needed to accommodate my caring responsibilities, but I know that not everyone has the same experience. And so it's really important for organisations to support carers appropriately with adjustments too, even if they don't necessarily identify as disabled themselves. That could mean flexible or hybrid working to accommodate appointments or illness, emergency backup care benefits, or additional paid leave to support them with their caring commitments so that they're not having to take it out of their annual leave.
Great, thank you. And I wanted to end on a high note as well. So what would you say, and you can probably have two moments if you like, but is there a standout moment for you whilst you've been chair of the DSN, a rewarding moment whilst you've had this position?
Yeah, and actually I do have two examples.
That went very well. You know that.
The first is actually being appointed as chair, as I'm the first disabled person of colour to take on this leadership role in the DSN. You know, but in addition to being a woman of colour, I'm also from a working class background. I mentioned I was the first in my family to graduate from university and work in professional services. So being appointed as chair was a real moment of pride for me and an expression of faith by others in my determination to drive inclusive change that I do not take for granted. And the second was finding out that the Disabled Solicitors Network has been shortlisted for the Disability Initiative of the Year at the 2024 Women and Diversity in Law Awards. I'm thrilled to see the DSN receiving recognition for the fantastic work that we do. The results of that should be announced soon, so I'm keeping everything crossed.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's very exciting. Congratulations on being shortlisted. I wish you all the best of luck for that. Rina, this has been a really interesting, insightful conversation. I think it will help a lot of people at least to start this conversation about disability and realise, as you said before, that this is a majority issue, not a minority issue. Often I think people think, disability doesn't really affect many people, but actually it's the group any of us can belong to if we're not a member of the disability club already. So, you know, stick around long enough, you probably will become a member of the disability club in terms of illness, impairment, or just the general aging process. Any of us can belong to this group. Is there anything else you wanted to mention at this point? Any last words from you?
Just that, you know, as a network, we are going to continue to evolve. You know, we're always looking ahead at future challenges and opportunities. We're going to be led by a network in terms of what they need and want from us. So, you know, please join the conversation, join the Disabled Solicitors Network, join the Legal Neurodiversity Network, and, you know, be part of helping us drive the change to help the profession become more inclusive of disabled and neurodivergent people.
Yeah. And does the DSN go into law firms to give talks or talk to people?
We do. We're happy to go in to support law firm talks. You know, we're often on panels. We also speak at university events. And we notice a real increasing engagement during Disability History Month when a lot of firms are focused on this area of diversity. But we also support individual members. So, you know, we often get queries through that we do our best to help and support with. That the committee is really engaged and keen to help drive that change. So I'm very fortunate to work with such a wonderful group of people.
And they're very fortunate to have you as chair, Rena. Thank you so much for your time and thanks for a really enjoyable conversation.
Thank you, Yasmin. It was a pleasure.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing. Or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.